that happens every single year. And then you had at the same time with, you know, over during the summertime, you started to see, you know, shorts getting trapped in the market, derivative exposure starting to increase. You started to see more money coming in, momentum money was coming in on top of physical buying. You saw capital flows from mining companies just exploding. So all that culminating, just sort of pushing prices higher, forcing almost a sort of gamma squeeze on dealers that were short options going into October. And that actually started, that actually really heated the market up during that, you know, middle part of October. It's helping the silver market. Yeah, these are, you know, the acceleration of the usage of silver in solar panels and so forth, I think has shocked a lot of people over the last two or three, 4 years, in terms of the exponential sort of rate of usage of silver in those panels. but I think, you know, looking at, you know, the bigger picture, silver is also, and this came out last year, a silver battery, or putting silver into a battery, solid state battery format. You know, the idea that this battery could actually extend the life of the battery, I think, as well as cut down the charging time by half, as well as extend the range of that battery by double. These are things that could be explosive for a market. In the past, silver has been this sort of, like you said, the redheaded stepchild of the precious metals world, not getting any respect whatsoever. But now I think people are saying, hey, listen, this is, you know, there's some serious use cases for this, as well as, you know, with this push for gold, it just makes sense when you start looking at silver relative to gold, you know, through the gold silver ratio. You know, when's the last time you've ever seen silver peak at 80-to-1 ratio? I've never seen that. And so people are watching this and they're saying, listen, there's probably more upside in silver than there is in gold at this moment. And just for, you know, your viewers and full disclosure, I run a hedge fund in precious metals. I'm weighted about 74% silver, 24% roughly in gold, and about 2-3% in physical platinum.
Welcome back, everyone. This is Just Steve Yang with Natural Resource Stocks. Today we have Bob Coleman, manager of Profits Plus Capital Management's Profits Plus Precious Metals, and founder of Idaho Armored Vaults. Bob, first of all, make sure I got that correct, but I'm really grateful to have your perspective here today on some global forces driving the precious metals market. It's a great honor to have you here.
Sure, Steve. Thank you for having me on.
So, Bob, I want to talk to you about gold. Gold has surged recently. It's, you know, with central banks shifting policies, or, you know, rate cuts, you know, mounting global debts, not really sure what's driving the price today, but what do you say is the main driver behind the gold price?
Yeah, I think a lot of the activity, especially the last few months on the physical side, has been more on the Asian demand. You just came out of Diwali in India, which is a festival season for them, which is very it's annual. It happens every time in fall, but this season happened to basically fall in the entire month of October. So you saw a massive amount of demand for gold relative to last year's October period, and you know, you're seeing this sort of in terms of you know, the demand for physical over in Asia, they're much more prone to actually own the physical item itself versus, even though ETFs have been a growing business in Asia, you still see India as one of the biggest buyers of physical metal.
So is this primarily being driven by India? I know that China's been a big buyer of gold, as well as Russia. I know that South Korea's been moving in that direction as well. What does the October period have to do with it? And if you can explain, just kind of people who aren't as familiar with the Asian October cycle.
Yeah, it's very, Diwali is just a festival season or a holiday that promotes a lot of, it's celebrated a lot of gift exchanging, especially gold, silver ornaments, things like that are bought and given. And so it's a very popular time for the precious metals industry. And that's very seasonal. That happens every single year. And then you had at the same time with, during the summertime, you started to see, shorts getting trapped in the market, derivative exposure starting to increase. You started to see more money coming in, momentum money was coming in on top of physical buying. You saw capital flows from mining companies just exploding. So all that culminating, just sort of pushing prices higher, forcing almost a sort of gamma squeeze on dealers that were short options going into October. And that actually really heated the market up during that, middle part of October. You just had the options and derivative markets that were just kind of like the tail wagging the dog. It was really pushing prices on an extreme basis.
But I'm curious, just wondering if you're thinking that we're due for a correction. Some say, gold may be forming a new long-term floor on the other side. Is it fairly valued? Is there more upside here as we finish 2025? Heading into 2026, what are you anticipating?
If you could tell me what President Trump is going to say tomorrow, I could probably answer that question. It's been a very volatile period, a very unpredictable period. I think part of what's driving flows to gold is just this anxiety and uncertainty that is kind of surrounding trade policy and, like you said, deficit spending, debt creation, debt servicing. And then you have this going on around the world. You have Japan that's, just printing money. Their currency is falling. I mean, you have it. It's a global story that I think that's one of the reasons why central banks have been buyers of metals, not just the last year, but, over the last 10 years, they've been picking up the pace and trying to protect their balance sheet, trying to protect against currency debasement, as well as potentially political, having a neutral reserve asset that's not, potentially could be picked at politically by another country. So, and at the same time, the U.S. is trying to come out with stable coins and, their policy is to try and create a digital environment to sort of be the backstop to kind of meet, try to inflate assets, I guess, but try to also initiate or issue more treasuries into the market. Whereas the world, I think, is looking at and saying, hey, listen, there's a lot of treasuries out here. Maybe we want some gold instead of the treasuries as a as a sort of a mechanism, as a neutral reserve asset to protect and maybe collateralize from instead of collateralizing the treasuries. So I think it's a very broad stroke or macro picture that you can maybe create from here.
But looking back at the last major bull run for gold, I mean, with 2001 and 2011, you saw a huge rally. Do you see similar macro and sentiment trends today? I mean, could we be gearing up for another multi-year rally such as the one we saw in the past?
Yeah, that market, as you just mentioned, I think it was 13 years in a row, gold went up every single year. Amazing. And in 2008, it was one of the only assets that was actually up on the year besides T-bills or treasury notes at the during that fiasco of the financial crisis. So I think the setup is there for this potential push higher. I think a lot of people are trying to pick the top. You're definitely consolidating at the right level here. This pullback that we had from the October highs, you had about an 8 or 10% correction, a little bit more of a correction in silver, which I think eliminated or reduced a lot of the fluff and sort of the late comers coming into the market, especially the traders that use a lot of leverage and margin. They got shaken out, which is very typical. But this idea that silver's been holding, above 48, gold's been holding that 4,000 area, that's very telling. I mean, if you're short the market, expecting for maybe this year-end, maybe profit-taking event or tax loss selling, that type of thing, there's not much losses to take tax loss selling with in the precious metals area. So, you may not see that. And at the end of the day, you may see a reversal higher, even with maybe asset allocators, you know, maybe reducing portion sizes of precious metals because they've had such a great run, you know, on a percentage basis. Precious metals may be a larger portion of the portfolio that, you know, that, mm-hmm. you know, these allocators will maybe tend to allow. So you may see some curtailing there, but that may not happen until, you know, after the new year. So it's, you're going into that year end with potentially a lot of, you know, collateral that could be used to, on a basis to expand positions.
Yeah. So with gold being the price that it is, you know, there's a lot of FOMO. And, you know, they don't want to miss the boat on the profits. Now, you know, geopolitical tensions rising and the financial system under stress, how should investors be thinking about gold? Should they be looking at it as an inflation hedge, a safe haven, financial fire insurance? Should they chase the upside? I mean, when headlines move the price, what fundamentals or metrics do you watch? And how do you think that we should be thinking about gold?
Yeah, as a long-term investor, what you just mentioned, you could almost say all the above, you know, as a reason to own gold. I think part of the issue with gold ownership in the short run is the volatility. It can, you know, for people that aren't used to this asset class, you have to remember there's a lot of newcomers coming in. You know, they see the price, it's up 60% on the year, and they're like, I want a piece of that. And they're not used to these big swings that you may not normally see in the stock market that you, is very commonplace in the precious metals, especially in the mining sector. So that can shake people up. But I think if you're owning this metal or this asset class, you're really buying it for the longer term picture of, hey, listen, is the government fixing, or the U.S. government or any government for that matter, actually fixing their fiscal situation? Or is this basically an extended pretend across really all boundaries of trying to figure out how do we, you know, maintain our capital servicing costs? At the same time, how do we keep spending money? Because I haven't seen any country really curtail their spending to a large degree, you know, that would actually, you know, really strengthen their currency per se. So, that's longer term sort of, you know, back of the business card type answer, I guess you could say.
Are you saying that spending beyond our means is not a problem exclusive to the U.S.?
Yeah, some say we're the dirtiest, I guess the cleanest shirt in the dirty laundry, but, you know, the numbers are huge. I mean, there's no question that, you know, every country, it's an inflate or die policy, and I think this has turned into almost like economic warfare in a way.
Bob, I want to jump to silver a bit, if we can shift gears. I mean, silver's got its own personality, so I wanted to give silver its own time here. You know, silver's always been, you know, it's got, you know, qualities, I guess, and has been viewed as both metal, as monetary, and as industrial. And so, you know, it's often it acts as like gold's younger, volatile, younger sibling is kind of how I've heard it said. Does its cadence alongside gold, you know, just kind of like how it follows gold, but it just seems to be more volatile and moody. Does the fact that its cadence kind of mirrors gold, does that reflect its role as money, or does its volatility indicate that it's becoming more like an industrial metal like copper? How do you see silver?
Yeah, silver, for those that don't know, with your audience, silver has been money longer than gold has, actually. It was used as coinage well before gold was, and so it's been a more of a stable monetary metal for a long time. But you're right, 75% of the usage or demand for silver now is industrial. You know, it's the most reflective metal in the world. It's the most conductive metal in the world. So it's antimicrobial. I mean, it has a lot of different properties that can, you know, easily be substituted for. And so that's one of the reasons why industry uses it for, you know, solar panels and you know, electronics and so forth. Mm-hmm. And as this sort of energy, green energy surge, or this, you know, idea of data centers and so forth, trying to get more power, you know, the idea of using more solar power to maybe make this more, you know, data centers more of a viable operation, it's helping the silver market. These are, you know, the acceleration of the usage of silver in in solar panels and so forth, I think has shocked a lot of people over the last two or three, 4 years, in terms of the exponential sort of rate of usage of silver in those panels. but I think, you know, looking at, you know, the bigger picture, silver is also, and this came out last year, a silver battery, or putting silver into a battery, solid state battery format. You know, the idea that this battery could actually extend the life of the battery, I think, as well as cut down the charging time by half, as well as extend the range of that battery by double. These are things that could be explosive for a market. And that's where, when you see the silver price moving like it is, yes, everyone looks at the volatility. They look at investment demand, because investment demand has typically been the driver of price, because that's sort of the that difference between, you know, industry usage and sort of the, you know, that extra dollar of purchasing that actually would start pressing silver when it was, you know, when its supply was maybe tight, and so you'd see silver reacting more to investment flows in terms of price action. But you know, when you're looking at industry and you're trying to figure out, okay, the next 2 to 5 years, for example, you're trying to understand, okay, what other applications can silver be used for? And the way technology is moving and growing and so forth, you know, these are things that will force prices of silver higher if we're in these supply deficits that a lot of people talk about, especially over the last 5 years, where each year there's more usage than there is actual mining supply. Ultimately, that supply is going to come from above ground stocks, and those above ground stocks will only sell at the price that they dictate. And that's one of the reasons why I think platinum has done very well this year as well, is this story that, you know, silver is not just simply this, you know, industrial metal. It has this hybrid type of mentality that actually is during times like these could be a huge benefit. And I think it attracts a wider audience now than maybe it used to be. Because, you know, in the past, silver has been this sort of, like you said, the redheaded stepchild of the precious metals world, and not getting any respect whatsoever. But now I think people are saying, hey, listen, this is, you know, there's some serious use cases for this, as well as, you know, with this push for gold. It just makes sense when you start looking at silver relative to gold, you know, through the gold silver ratio. You know, when's the last time you've ever seen silver peak at 80-to-1 ratio? I've never seen that. And so people are watching this and they're saying, listen, there's probably more upside in silver than there is in gold at this moment. And just for, you know, your viewers and full disclosure, I run a hedge fund in precious metals. I'm weighted about 74% silver, 24% roughly in gold, and about 2-3% in physical platinum. And that's all physical metal held outside the financial system in the fund I manage. So I see sort of this progression, I think, with silver, that it takes time. It's not going to happen overnight. But I think the setup is definitely there.
So in terms of the setup and in terms of, you know, the different industries that's being used for, you mentioned solar, EV, I mean, is there, you know, they talk about, you know, the silver bulls talk about the silver squeeze. Is that, you know, is that what you're seeing? Is that grounded in reality, in real supply and demand, or is it just overblown?
Part of it's overblown. Part of it is there's some factual evidence to it. I mean, the in October you had a true gamma squeeze developing in the options markets. You saw it with the borrowing fees to short SLV shares. You saw, I did a post on this where the amount of short activity by market makers shorting SLV going into that option expiration week was truly just historic. I've never seen that much shorting going on by market makers, basically using shorting activity to absorb capital flows going into SLV that would normally force a share creation by authorized participants to create more shares to meet this demand. And so, I wrote a couple posts on this trying to explain. It's a little bit technical, but basically when you start looking at sort of the microstructure of the markets, and that's one of the things I look at, is you see this fails to delivery that was just happening in a very big cluster of time. You never really saw that before. Yes, 2021, we saw this spike at the end of January, and then that set off this silver squeeze sort of mentality. But all that basically was the precious metals industry squeezing the consumer. It had absolutely nothing to do with the price of the metals. There was a lot of hype, a lot of propaganda, a lot of promotional type material that was unfortunately dished out and forced a lot of people to vastly overpay for precious metals back then.
So is there something like that that can be happening now? I've had people on here just saying, I don't know who's buying the crap out of silver, but it's someone's buying the crap out of silver. And, you know, we talk off camera a little bit about manipulation of silver. If you can tell me just kind of what's going on with silver, is someone manipulating it? Is it overpriced here? Do we got to be mindful of that as we think about investing in silver at this time?
Yeah. I mean, from a manipulation standpoint, I think, there's a lot of that talk that goes around from the promoter crowd and the retail dealer crowd, unfortunately, and they use this as a sales tool to get people hot and bothered and get them off the couch to buy metals. And then if the market goes down, and especially when they charge very high premiums for their products. So when the market goes down, they have a boogeyman to basically say, aha, it's that guy that JP Morgan or somebody else that manipulated the market down. It wasn't necessarily just simply market forces of natural supply and demand. Because most of the people that sort of promulgate the manipulation theory aren't industry participants on the financial side. You know, they don't really understand the exchange for physical premium, the spreads between London and New York and how the futures markets work and the hedging mechanisms in place and a lot of the spreads, trades and so forth that are done by banks. The banks don't really take a secular look at the metals. They're there to, because they work on a balance sheet, a leveraged balance sheet, so they make money on spreads and hedging more so than they take a, listen, I think we're going to just drive silver right into the ground. Yes, you've had the cases with JP Morgan and so forth on the spoofing of silver and other asset classes as well that they got nailed for. But that was actually very, very short-term trading of actually trying to push the price not only lower, but also higher. In fact, I think there was more times they were spoofing the market higher than they were lower. But those are very, very short sort of effects on the market. It wasn't like this manipulation, like a lot of people think, long-term manipulation of price suppression and so forth. Well, if you look at the price of silver or gold since 2000, that manipulation has been a horrible trade. I mean, because gold's gone up, you know, more so than the stock market has. So that kind of kills that narrative. Yes, short term, you're going to have players on leverage and on margin, and they're going to get squeezed in both directions. You're going to have stop loss selling as well as stop loss buying if you're short the market. So positions get pressed in either direction. But you know, if you're looking at silver right now, for example, and say, hey, listen, it's at $50 an ounce or $51 an ounce. Do I buy it here? Yeah, you have to look at, during a bull market, you tend to look at supply and demand and a lot of these types of numbers of deficits and so forth. But in a bear market, you tend to look at the cost of production. And so the cost of production right now for silver is about $28 an ounce and rising. And I think if energy prices start going up, you're going to see that cost of production start to increase even higher. But so this idea that silver will come crashing back down to $15 an ounce, I don't see that. In fact, actually, every time silver pulls back, it's very limited in nature. You had this in April, you had this big washout from 34.5 down to about 28.5 in about a week or two time frame. And some very big money managers I heard were coming in at 28.5, 29 and buying silver at that point. And that was low. That once it fell, had that water sort of fall moment, it stopped going down and it just started rebuilding the base. And you're seeing that's been sort of the signal for silver this last couple of years is it initially has this sort of watershed moment where it crashes or pulls back hard, and then that's it. And then it rebuilds. And that's a sign of a bull market. And that's something I try to put out on a daily basis on my X feed, trying to explain to people and give them sort of a roadmap of what to look for, maybe what to expect, what the setup is currently, to help people understand, you know, this idea. It's not manipulation that's moving all this stuff around. There's a lot of participants trading this market, and a lot of players with a lot of money. And you have to remember, the silver market is tiny compared to the stock market and fixed income markets and currency markets. So, when big money comes in, it can have a really outsized effect on this asset.
Bob, as you think about, you know, major macro, geopolitical, technological trends, let's say in the next 5 years, do you anticipate or expect something? Let's say it's de-dollarization or green energy. Some transition that could dramatically reshape demand for gold, silver.
Yeah, gold is primarily more of an investment vehicle. So I don't see the industry side, as prices have been going up. In fact, jewelry demand has been falling off, which is pretty typical. I think it's really the idea of debasement. It's really the idea of how are governments going to fix their fiscal issues? How are they going to maintain their debt structure? How are they going to continue to fund their deficit spending and so forth? Those are, I think, what most people are watching for. And as long as the central banks are coming in and adding to positions and talking about wanting to add more gold to the portfolio, I think that's just giving confidence to the investment community that says, okay, maybe there is some, because a lot of times with central banks, it's not just simply their actions. A lot of it's also moral suasion. I mean, the Federal Reserve is very famous for this. Greenspan talked about this a lot. Just the idea of creating sort of a speech or some type of policy just to get a market's reaction so they could see what the but the potential effects could be. Central banks could be doing that too, in a way to create more of this a softer environment to try to inflate out of this mess, because certainly governments aren't doing anything really to help themselves. And I think politicians around the world, they're backed into a corner. I mean, do they go to austerity and lose their jobs, or do they, this populism trend and so forth, this rising anger, throughout the world in terms of, hey, listen, I've been left behind. You mm-hmm. have this sort of K-shaped recovery where income inequality at all-time highs, and the poor are getting poorer and the rich are getting richer. These types of things people watch for. And this is where, the metals tend to thrive, is in uncertainty, especially if we're walking into a potential recession as well.
Do you anticipate, I know that we are talking about not having a crystal ball because we don't know what President Trump's going to say tomorrow, but do you have any projections of where things are going in the new year?
Yeah, I think walking into this idea of this melt-up scenario in the markets, I think you kind of have to look at this. It's this narrative, I think, that's pushing the general market higher is there's a lot of government sort of push, I guess you could say, because of the wealth effect, because of tax revenue bases and so forth. I don't think they can afford a market to go down hard. The problem is, at some point, market forces are going to force that. But currently right now, you have the market basically at any time there's any type of sign of stress, all of a sudden you get politicians, you get Federal Reserve board members, other central banks saying, hey, listen, maybe we should be cutting rates. They become a lot softer and a lot more dovish very quickly. And I think that's this idea that there's so much debt, and a lot of that debt is coming due, especially from the COVID era where you had a lot of people financed, very short-term finance rates and so forth near 0%. A lot of that's coming due from 2026 onward. So, you know, there's almost this, you know, there's that force that you can have a deleveraging event, but at the same time, to meet that deleveraging event, you're going to have this stimulative type of effort to try and throw more gasoline on the fire. And so it's trying to balance out the two at the same time. Yes, there's going to be a lot of volatility and so forth. But I just don't, you know, from my standpoint, at some point, the metals will become overvalued relative to other asset classes. I haven't seen that yet because, it, you know, as long as we're continually pumping out more treasuries and so forth, you know, it gives more credence to gold, I think.
Bob, with, you know, so many people looking to invest in gold but not knowing where to invest, if you can tell us a little bit about kind of what you do with Idaho Armored Vaults, Profit Plus Management, Profit Plus Precious Metals, and if you could, you know, kind of give us a kind of idea of how you would build a model portfolio. I mean, there's so many ways to invest, you know, physical metals, ETF futures, mining stocks, and how do you guide a new investor?
Yeah, I think you have to kind of categorize yourself first as, am I a trader or am I an investor? Secondly, you know, because if you're a trader, you know, the mining stocks and the ETFs and so forth, you can get in and out very quickly. You can put these stop losses in. There's more flexibility, I would say, versus buying a physical product, you know, because when you're buying a physical product, I think for the people that are looking at gold and silver, for example, on a longer term basis, that says, hey, listen, maybe the price action isn't why I'm buying it. Maybe it's because of the counterparty risk and the systemic risk issues that I'm seeing out there, that if we ever do have this deleveraging event and all of a sudden, you know, the Federal Reserve just starts printing money again and liquefying the system, having an asset outside the system that doesn't have counterparty risk or someone else's promise to pay becomes much more of an advantage, I think. And that's one of the reasons back in 2006 and seven, when I started looking at the metals, I started my career back in 92, 93 with Dean Witter. So I've been in the investment business a long time, but 2006 and seven, I saw the markets melting up. I was like, this is not going to end well. And so I looked at the metals as an asset class to hold outside the system, given the counterparty and systemic risks that were building in 2006 and seven. Of course, 2008 happened and everything hit the fan. But I think now the question for a lot of people is, you know, especially people that are very wealthy, because that's been the attraction this year, has been much higher net worth individuals, ultra high net worth individuals without much gold or silver participation in their portfolio, looking at the metals and saying, listen, I like the idea of physical because it is something that's not tied to, you know, a mouse click where I may not get scared out of the position as easy. And so I'm forced to hold on to it. But it's also that narrative that says, I like the idea of, you know, I can always just pass this stuff down to my kids. If I, you know, if I don't need it, they may. And unfortunately, the Wall Street and the financial services industry doesn't really like physical metal for that sole purpose that when the client buys that metal, they typically hold it long term, which I think is the way to look at this. So you don't get scared on these, you know, these drawdowns of 10 or 20% corrections.
So it's more of have it and forget it. Is it kind of like fire insurance sort of thing? Do you recommend a certain way to hold, like for those who are looking for tangible metal?
Yeah.
What benefit do you see with that? And what do you is it important to do offshore? Is it important to do a vault? Is it important to have some like in between the wall sort of thing? Like, what do you recommend in terms of how you hold it as well as the form? Do you like the eagles? Do you like the bullion? What do you like?
Yeah, those are all great questions. To give your audience just a little bit of background on myself, we run a depository that stores about $1.2 billion in assets. I also run a precious metals service where we buy and sell precious metals for clients. And we tend to be one of the cheapest organizations on the price side, beating every dealer, online dealer I know of consistently since 2009. So I look at this from sort of this advisory type of mentality of saying, listen, we got to reduce the spreads. So I don't mark up a lot. We also buy back at prices that beat most of the dealers in the country as well. So that's important too. When people are looking at physical metal, shop around. You know, the Eagles versus 1 ounce gold bars, for example, American Eagle coins. They're all bullion products. You just got to buy them at the right time. You don't want to buy when the industry is really hyping up a certain product like American Silver Eagles. You know, back in October, those premiums blew out to $10 to $12 over spot. Now you can buy them back for about $3.50 over spot again. And so if you bought them at a high premium, you have that spread or premium risk that you have to deal with. So you know, when you're looking at products, just try to ask a lot of questions, trying to find out what's the best deal. You know, there's a lot of good gold and silver products out there, whether it's sovereign coins or 1 ounce bars. At any given time, coins may be cheaper than bars. You just never know. Now, I'm a big believer that clients or individuals, I should say, should hold metal directly. So they either hold it, for example, if they're comfortable holding it at their house, remove that counterparty risk. If they have it at a depository, make sure they have a direct relationship with that depository. And that's what I created. What they want to avoid, I think, in my opinion, is these gold and silver programs that are really run by gold dealers that have a master a sub relationship, say with a larger depository, where they basically have the account, the client buys the metal through the dealer, and the dealer controls that depository account. In that situation, the client is giving up that control and adding counterparty risks to the equation, which I think they should stay away from at all times. Plus, what's even worse than that is they're now locking in that trade with the dealer. So the dealer now controls, when that client goes to sell, the dealer controls the bid price as well. And what we're seeing in the industry, because it's completely unregulated, is dealers have really taken consumers to the woodshed with regard to very high spreads, meaning the cost to buy the product and then the cost to sell the product are really wide margins. And so that tends to eat into the client's ability to make money or maintain purchasing power.
Bob, you mentioned your websites, the precious metals as well as the vaults. If you can give the website the website as well as kind of what these services are all about and how people can benefit from it.
Yeah. Our website is goldsilvervault.com. And then you can also find me on X at Profits Plus ID. And so I put out a lot of information there. We also have interviews and articles on goldsilvervault.com's media page as well. So people can go to that. You know, there's also a buy page where you can look at live premiums for certain products. So if you just want to compare, you know, what we sell products for versus any online bullion dealer out there, you'll see a noticeable difference. I mean, a big difference. And then also we have information on storing metals and so forth. Everything we do is fully segregated, fully insured with the Lloyd's of London all risk policy. That actually insures for mysterious disappearance as well as employee theft, which are normal exclusions in many of these policies. So certainly try to look at the website, the articles. If you're looking at, hey, how do I determine if a depository is good or not? I've done podcasts and written articles on how to select a depository, what to ask for, what risks are involved. You know, we just walked away from one of the largest depository thefts and losses in U.S. history with First State Depository. I think the CFTC mentioned it was like $115 million loss. And that was a fully segregated environment.
Was that a mysterious disappearance, as you said?
It was more like fraud. Yeah, he got a lot of years in jail for that, or prison. But it's unfortunate because, you know, people believe in, especially with these precious metal IRAs, which are heavily promoted to the public as well. The reason why dealers love those that style of investing is typically the average transactional size is much bigger than, you know, a guy just buying, a monthly accumulation of precious metals. So you got to be, if you're investing and looking into IRAs, you got to really look at the dealer. You got to really look at the IRA custodian, because now there's a couple IRA custodians that I think are involved in class action lawsuits because of the fall. Yeah, one was because of the fallout from First State Depository. Another one was because of Oxford Gold Group, which was a gold dealer in California that was taking orders from clients in precious metals for IRAs and regular accounts, and never delivered the metals. They just took the money and ran. And so now this, the SEC is, I think, getting involved. The CFTC is getting involved, and they're looking at these precious metal IRA custodians out there saying, hey, listen, you're not just an administrator. You're acting as a fiduciary. When you handle someone's IRA account, it's up to you to do some due diligence on this dealer, because if you're sending monies to that dealer and you're being paid to send monies to that dealer, you have some responsibility. And I think that's where this industry is very susceptible to a lot of risk, especially if prices start to come down. A lot of this stuff can really unwind fast.
So I've had a solo 401 k account, and these retirement IRA accounts is, you can invest by having vaults hold physical gold. Now, do you do that as well? And
we do get involved with 401ks, IRAs, and so forth, foreign accounts, individuals, retail, high net worth, institutional. So we do all that type of custodial work or storage work. But when you get involved with 401ks or IRAs, you want to obviously look at a self-directed IRA custodian, and then just do your due diligence. There's a lot of them out there. We work with a few good ones out there, that we haven't had any issues with, and clients seem to prefer. But definitely you want to ask a lot of questions if you're going down that road of putting some retirement money into the precious metals. And most importantly, the products you're looking at, just don't overpay for products. There's a lot of precious metal IRA companies out there that are selling these half ounce gold coins, 1.25 ounce, 1.5 ounce silver coins that are made from the Royal Canadian Mint or the Perth Mint in Australia, that are just bullion products, but they're heavily marked up. I mean, we're talking 60 to 80% markups, and the client will never make money buying these products. So definitely, if you see a gold company that has an endorsement figurehead on their website, run. Because typically it costs a lot of money to endorse that guy. Yeah, to pay for those endorsements, and they're going to make their money back by in the markup of the metals that they're selling. So just be careful of all this. There's a lot of that goes on in an industry that unfortunately is unregulated.
Bob, sometime I'd love to have you on to get your input on how to assess these, the good ones from the bad ones. But thank you for your time, for your insights. I will put your links on for our listeners in the show notes. So this is, again, Steve Yang learning alongside from people like you, from people smarter than me. For everyone, stay smart, stay curious, stay disciplined. Bob, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.